From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember journalist David Halberstam. He died yesterday in a car crash at the age of 73. Halberstam won a 1964 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Vietnam for the New York Times. He was one of the first American reporters to contradict the optimistic picture of the war that the American government was presenting to the public. Halberstam went on to write books about the men in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations who led the war, the rise of the mass media, and the 1950s, as well as many books about how sports reflect American values. We'll listen back to excerpts of several of our interviews with him. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews Old School, the new CD by Coco Taylor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to remember a great journalist, David Halberstam. He died in a car crash yesterday at the age of 73. Halberstam won a 1964 Pulitzer Prize for reporting from Vietnam for the New York Times. He was one of the first American reporters to contradict the optimistic picture of the war that the American government was presenting to the public. South Vietnamese and American officials tried to discredit his reporting by attacking it for negativism and inaccuracy. David Halberstam retired from newspaper reporting in 1967 to write books and magazine articles. 8 years later, he wrote the book The Best and the Brightest about the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and the war. In his book The Powers That Be, he documented the growth of American mass media. In today's Washington Post obituary, Halberstam was described as having written almost 24 nonfiction books that gave his readers a vivid behind-the-scenes portrayal of the history of their times. Halberstam often wrote about how American values were expressed through sports. In 1985, he told me he was once an athlete himself, but in college had to choose between sports and journalism.
I played on the freshman basketball team. I had a full-time job, and I started working for the Harvard Crimson. At a certain point, it became very clear to me that I was being offered a career choice, and I dropped freshman basketball, which I sort of liked and actually was doing, I think, reasonably well at, and at that point became a journalist and spent about 50 or 60 hours a week on the Harvard Crimson. And that was, with a finality that I did not know at the time, was the ultimate career choice for me because I never turned back. Not only did I turn my back on basketball, a little chance that I might have had as a career there, but I turned my back on law school, business school, PhD, anything else. I found something that I loved, and this was the first thing I'd ever been good at. You take an obsessive personality that, like mine, who's floundering in his social environment, and you finally give him or her something that allows him to be distinguished, and you have a match.
You moved to New York eventually to join the New York Times.
I joined the Times, was hired by the Washington Bureau, didn't have a terribly good tour in Washington. This is some 24 and a half years ago. And then very quickly was sent to what was then the Congo, now Zaire, and then very quickly after that, really 23 years ago, to Vietnam.
You asked to be transferred to Vietnam, and you wanted to go there at a time when very few Americans were paying any attention to Indochina.
And very few reporters wanted to go, yeah. 1962.
What did you foresee happening? What did you know?
I could tell that it was going to be an extraordinary story. I mean, I think reporters go where there are stories. I had just come out of the Congo. I'd spent 13 or 14 months there. It was a good story. It was an important story. There was a lot of action. Vietnam seemed to me to be rising up almost as an issue like the Spanish Civil War, that it was going to be this traumatic thing, that large forces were, unlike in the Congo, large forces were going to be engaged there. We had just made the Kennedy commitment of, I think, about 15,000 advisors, and for better or for worse, something was going to be played out there. I probably thought that we had a chance to win, and I was more hawkish than dovish when I first went, but whatever else, I knew that it was something that I wanted to cover. I was confident that I had, by then, the physical courage to do it. I was 27 years old, or 28, I guess, when I first got there finally, 28, and I was single, so I wasn't like I had a family or estranged to hold back. I wanted to be a part of it, and I was very excited when I got the assignment and filled with enthusiasm.
Did you talk to any reporters who were or who had been in Vietnam before you got there? And did they give you any advice?
Sure. I was the first full-time correspondent covering the Vietnam. I have a small badge in history. I was the first reporter for a daily newspaper to be on permanent assignment in Vietnam. And I replaced one of the really legendary reporters of our in any age, Homer Biggert, who had won two Pulitzer Prizes, one in World War II, one in the Korean War, and who was a particular hero of mine anyway. And Homer had written me long cautionary letters about what to expect, who to trust, who not to trust, and letting me know that it was going to be a very, very hard assignment. I mean, that I was going to get belted around, he thought it probably was not going to work well, that the war was not going to be won, and therefore the reporter for the New York Times had better be prepared to be scapegoated and blamed if he wrote negatively.
Well, it seems to me that American and South Vietnamese government let you know that you should be thinking about being a team player.
Get on the team. That's what they used to say. The American ambassador to Vietnam, Mr. Nolting, once turned to me, and I had come back from a particularly grim tour of the Mekong Delta, where all my sources told me that we were losing the war. And I mentioned this in passing to him once. He just got furious at me, almost physically threw me out of his office and said, "You're always looking for the hole in the donut. You're always looking for the hole in the donut." The great pressure, what they were trying to do was make us be patriots. I have a rather broad gauge view of patriotism and the high levels of freedom in a society like ours. I don't think I need automatically to do what some general tells me to do. I mean, I don't need to accept his definition of patriotism. I have a lot of confidence in my own patriotism and my own intelligence. But it was very tough there. There were attacks upon our sexuality, our patriotism, our political. Called communists. I mean, it was very nasty, and it was quite orchestrated out of the White House and the Defense Department.
Attacks on your sexuality? Am I to assume that people would call you homosexual if
you
didn't support the war?
Sissies, yeah. I mean, there was one, I remember one time, there was a general named Brute Krulak who gave a briefing, and one of my bete noirs was a woman reporter, right-wing woman reporter named Marguerite Higgins, and he went around saying that she had showed me pictures of Viet Cong bodies, and I had burst into tears. Wasn't true, and I later confronted him. The story should have been true. I mean, I should have probably broken into tears, but I mean, it was that kind of thing of trying to undermine the credibility, the legitimacy that we didn't have in those days, some more than 20 years ago. We didn't have the word the machismo, but I mean, that was really an attempt to say that this guy is a sissy, and he can't stand the sight of blood.
Was there a reward and punishment system that was used for reporters who played the game or didn't?
Well, that was the interesting thing. They tried to, and they just didn't have any rewards to hand out. I mean, they didn't have anything to punish with. I mean, it wasn't like that was the early days of the Kennedy administration. The Kennedys were very good at rewarding reporters. If you were, I suppose, good and talented, you got to be invited to Hickory Hill or to the White House, or that you were favored, or at the press conference, perhaps the president called you by your first name, or Pierre Salinger would have lunch with you. I mean, the magnetic pull of the Kennedy social swirl was rather powerful then. We were 12,000 miles away. We could care bleep all about whether Jack or Jackie had us for dinner. We could care less whether we were invited to the embassy for dinner or by the general for dinner. I mean, they were a distant world. Our friends were the young Americans who were out in the as advisors in the war, and then the Vietnamese as well. They were risking their lives. Every time we went out, we risked our lives, and that was quite often. And the last thing in the world we were going to do is, having risked our lives to cover a story, I was not going to cover up. I mean, having taken one risk, I wasn't going to play it cool. So they had no reward system. There was no social world that we wanted to be a part of. And the people that I respected, the people whose good wishes I wanted, were the people out, the advisors in the field. I wanted their respect. I mean, they were my sources. I didn't want them to tell me one thing and then look in the Times and see a rather watered-down story. I mean, that meant something to me. So the kind of control, social control, that a government has just didn't work on us at all. They tried it, and they tried to, you know, they played rough. If we did pessimistic stories, they would try and find our sources and punish them, and that, of course, just made us work harder.
What about the pressure, though, on those aides and advisors who were your sources. I'm surprised that there wasn't more pressure on them from the State Department.
There was a lot from the Defense Department. There was a lot, but they were, I think most of them were the kind of men who were responding to events, and I think they had young men on their staffs who were getting killed, and I think you can be theoretical about a war when you're in headquarters. You can sit there and be cynical about it. I think when you're in the field and you have young men who have died and you're writing letters to their widows, I don't think you're going to lie to a reporter whom you've come to know and trust. So I think that they were willing to risk their careers in many ways. I had a great source there named John Vann, who was a colonel and in the 7th Division advising the Arvin 7th Division there. And I remember when he finally pulled him back and I went to the airport to put him on the plane back to America. A whole bunch of us who were reporters gave him a little silver cigarette tray with his name. It said John Vann, John Paul Vann, good soldier, good friend, and we all signed it. I think there's 5 or 6 Pulitzer Prize winners on that signature. And I remember talking to John, and I said I was nervous that my reporting was going to hurt you. And he gave me a very flinty look, and he said, "You never hurt me anymore that I wanted to be hurt." So they knew what they were doing.
There were a few reporters who were expelled from Vietnam, I think by Madame Nu, because she was dissatisfied.
Well, I was right on the list. They once threw out a guy named Jim Robinson, who was NBC, and Francois Sully was expelled for about a year. I mean, the only real thing you had to worry about was expulsion. At the time that government fell, they had me down, instead of a year's visa, they had me down to a 1-month-at-a-time visa. I mean, I was on a very thin thread, and that was certainly one thing I did not want to happen, which was to be expelled. Well, but you cannot write for your visa. You can never write for your visa.
Well, Madame Nu had said about you, Halberstam should be barbecued, and I would be glad to supply the fluid and the match. Did you ever go through periods of self-censorship saying, is this story worth getting thrown out?
Oh, I think every reporter always in a situation when you're dealing with an authoritarian government that is monitoring you. I don't think self-censorship is the phrase, but you are always, you're aware of the amount of powder that you have and how much to use on a given story. I mean, if a big story comes in, you go with it, but you don't, I think, quickly, you don't lightly and gratuitously force an issue. I mean, I think every reporter is always in a situation like that, whether he's in the Soviet Union or whatever. He's aware that, you know, that he's balancing the need to be candid and inform his readers with the need to be able to survive as a reporter, and that takes a certain suppleness. But never self-censorship there. That was too important. If it had come to self-censorship, I'd have just, you know, pulled the plug and gone, because it was too much. Too much was at stake.
What were some of the stories that you wrote that most upset or irked American and Vietnamese officials?
Oh, it was not any one story. It was, although there was a couple stories I had that about the decline, the military decline in the Mekong Delta that really drove them crazy. It was a cumulative thing. With President Kennedy, for instance, it was that my reporting day in and day out on the front page of the New York Times reflected a first-class foreign policy failure. I mean, he was enraged by it. By the end of his life, in the last couple months of his life, the whole thing was unraveling, and my colleague and I, Neil Sheehan, had just such good sources that we had that country wired. And he was just, I mean, he used to complain. I mean, he was complaining about me, and then he would also complain to Arthur Schlesinger Jr. that he could find out more in my stories than he could from reading the State Department cables and from the military cables. And then there were a series of stories on the Mekong Delta, on the military decline there, that they just went crazy about. Kennedy really, I think, believed them, and he sent the military off to sort of come up with their view, and they sent a hot young brigadier general named Dick Stilwell out to sort of word-by-word challenge my stories. And, I mean, he's a real handler on that one. In his version, the war was being won. He challenged every single word in my stories, and unfortunately, as the Pentagon Papers later made clear in one of their reports, my version was a good deal more accurate than his. But it was the kind of politics. I mean, I was running up against the politics of the American Defense Department.
Kennedy called your editor at the Times and suggested, you know, maybe they were thinking about transferring you. Maybe you'd gotten too close to the story.
Yeah. Well, that happens whenever you are giving people. I mean, Kennedy was never worried about anybody being too close to the story if he was getting his version.
What was the Times reaction to that Kennedy request?
Oh, they were very good. I was supposed to come on home leave about then. They asked me to delay it for a couple of months, so they didn't want to look like they were acquiescing. They were quite good in general. I mean, they were made nervous by it. I don't think any... I mean, it's a very different circumstance. Those 25 years ago, everybody still had a World War II mentality. The idea that our generals might either be liars or fools was hard for... you know, patriotic men of that generation to understand. Here was their young reporter who was making the entire network of the embassy angry. And, you know, these were men that they had known, Maxwell Taylor and others they'd known in World War II, who were good and worthy men. And what was going wrong? So they were nervous by it, but they stood by me pretty well.
David Halberstam, recorded in 1985. He died yesterday in a car crash. We'll continue our remembrance with a 1999 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Remembering the journalist David Halberstam, he was killed in a car crash yesterday at the age of 73. He established his reputation reporting on the war in Vietnam and the men who led it. Many of his nearly two dozen nonfiction books were about sports. We're going to hear an excerpt of our 1999 interview, recorded after the publication of his book Playing for Keeps, Michael Jordan and the World He Made. It's about how Jordan became an icon and how his stature changed the NBA. Halberstam considered Jordan the most compelling and most charismatic athlete in all of sports in the 90s. He said basketball was in the midst of a renaissance the year Michael Jordan was drafted, thanks to the Magic Johnson-Larry Bird Lakers-Celtics rivalry. In Johnson and Bird's rookie year, 1979, the NBA had hit its commercial low point. I asked Halberstam why.
I think some of it was racism. It was not yet deeply rooted in the culture, perhaps. One spurt of growth had been a little too quick. The players were predominantly black, and there was a sense somehow that the players did not play hard, or they only played hard in the last 2 minutes. There was certainly a significant amount of drug use, and somehow it had not gotten into the American vein. On the eve of Larry Bird, on the time that Larry Bird and Magic Johnson entered the league for their rookie years, and they had starred in the NCAA final that spring. The finals in their first year, with Magic Johnson playing center without Kareem Abdul-Jabbar against the Philadelphia 76ers, was done nationally on a tape delay. I mean, I think that most of the country got it around midnight. So it, you know, the networks didn't even want it. That was the low point. And then, for a variety of reasons, the coming of Magic, Larry Bird, and then Michael, the skills of David Stern, the commissioner, the talents of Julius Erving as well, and the coming of Satellite and ESPN, which helped basketball dramatically, the game began to take hold and enjoyed a kind of golden age.
Now, David Stern became commissioner of the NBA the year that Michael Jordan arrived in the NBA, and you say that Stern wanted to turn around the NBA's image, and one of the things he was looking for was more corporate connections, more corporate sponsors. What were the difficulties he faced in getting that?
I think he faced the most elemental thing, which was racism. In an odd way, it seemed to affect basketball more. I mean, in part, baseball was the most rooted sport at that time and had its own base given popularity. Football is a sport of great violence where race didn't seem to make that much of a difference, in part because the coaches had more authority and control of the players, in part because they wear so much armor that race seems less a factor. You can barely tell the race of a particular player. But basketball, where they're virtually playing in their underwear, which was the blackest of sports, probably around 80 to 85% of the best players were black, seemed to have a problem. And when he tried to sell the sport, and people in his office, like Rick Welts, to large corporate potential sponsors, and they went to Madison Avenue, they kept hearing, your sport is too black. And they would say, well, what about the Final Four? You advertise the Final Four, and that's very black, too. And they said, and the answer would be, that's different. And what it was, I think, was that it meant that in the college game, the white system, the white hierarchy, the coaches, the colleges still could control their players, whereas in basketball, because it was professional, the level of authority of the white system had declined. Probably, in fact, that's why a lot of people didn't like John Thompson at Georgetown, because you had a sort of a black coach with a nascent sense of black nationalism coaching a predominantly, almost virtually all-black team, and that made some people nervous. So he ran into, I don't think there's any doubt, overt racism.
Well, certainly one of the things Michael Jordan did was show that, an African-American athlete could do a great job with it, with commercial endorsements.
Well, you see, and that's a breakthrough. That's a major change. You know, when I was young, self-evidently, the most attractive and charming and winning baseball player was arguably Willie Mays. I mean, he was ingenuous as a kid, full of enthusiasm, but there was a perception in the 50s and 60s that, you know, Madison Avenue's belief that a black with all that charm could not sell to whites. And I think they're wrong, by the way. I think Willie Mays, particularly generationally, transcended those barriers. I think he would have been a great salesman of cereal. I don't happen to want to eat cereal, but I think he would have done very well. The Jordan coming along with the Nike commercial and the Nike, Air Jordan shoes just took off. I mean, nobody was prepared for how well that did. And then suddenly, you know, the Nike thing broke it down for all these other companies, whether it was Big Macs, Coke, then Gatorade, Hanes underwear. Michael, with that dazzling smile, became the great salesman in America. This was a huge breakthrough.
David Halberstam recorded in 1999 after the publication of his book Playing for Keeps. Halberstam died in a car crash yesterday. We'll continue our remembrance in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Kiwis Might Fly, a New Zealand travel adventure by Polly Evans, author of It's Not About the Tapas. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Miramax Home Entertainment, presenting The Queen, starring Helen Mirren. Available on DVD April 24th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interviews with journalist David Halberstam as we continue our remembrance. Halberstam was killed in a car crash yesterday. And Myla Miles reviews the new recording by blues singer Coco Taylor. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering the journalist David Halberstam. He was killed in a car crash yesterday at the age of 73. In 1964, Halberstam shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on Vietnam for the New York Times. He was among the first journalists to challenge the optimistic picture of the war that American officials were presenting. He wrote nearly 24 books about politics, the media, the 1950s, the auto industry, and sports. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with him in 1999 after the publication of his book Playing for Keeps about how Michael Jordan changed the game of basketball. You have a photograph in your book of the Olympic Dream Team, you know, on the Olympic podium, and Michael Jordan has an American flag draped across his arm, covering up the Reebok logo on the uniform. I'm wondering how you think his endorsements for Nike affected his career and the choices he made during his career, and how he had to take care of his image.
He's extremely aware of the corporate sponsorship and his image. When he got to the Olympics at the Dream Team, you know, Reebok had this contract, and you were all supposed to wear the Reebok logo. Michael's a Nike man. That's so the big struggle there was not the U.S. versus the Soviet Union or the U.S. versus Lithuania or Yugoslavia. It was, you know, Reebok versus Nike. And, you know, were they going to wear, you know, were Nike men going to wear the logo? I think there's a great line of Charles Barkley. Someone said, well, are you going to do it? And Charles, who was a Nike man, said, I've got 2 million reasons not to do it. But if Charles had 2 million reasons each year not to do it, Michael probably had about 20 million reasons. So they finally worked out this compromise where Michael draped the flag over the Reebok logo. Now, the interesting thing is that at this point in the struggle, Michael was more impassioned than Phil Knight, the head of Nike. Phil thought it was getting out, the debate was getting out of hand, and he was going to be attacked for being anti-patriotic or whatever, and he was ready to give up the fight. Michael was sort of a little irritated that maybe Phil was not quite as much a warrior as Michael was in this heroic death day, doomsday battle against the evil forces of Reebok.
How do you think the Chicago Bulls coach Phil Jackson dealt with having a superstar on the team?
With extreme skill. Phil is an incredibly smart, deft man. I mean, for one thing, he dealt very well with Michael. He understood Michael's rage to be a winner. He was very smart in knowing that the one thing he must never do is ask Michael for anything. Michael's very tough and very predatory, and that he, Phil, would lose some authority as a coach if he asked Michael to do anything other than on the court. On the court, he understood one true thing about Michael. A, his love of the game and how hard he would play, and B, how desperately, by the time Phil Jackson became a coach, how desperately Michael wanted to be a champion, that he was tired of what people were saying, which was that he was a great individual player, but that he limited his team in terms of championship because it was too dependent upon him as a superstar. What Phil did in those critical first 2 years was sell the idea of Tex Winter's offense, which would what they call the triple motion offense, where the ball was shared a little bit. It was hard. It took away from some of Michael's individual glory, but it in fact made it harder on the defensive team. What he wanted to do was enhance Michael's greatness and his threat while keeping him from sucking the oxygen away from lesser players. And that takes great skill. When you have somebody like that around, it can be very, very hard on the other players because they become tentative. They tend to defer to the great players. What they wanted to do, and it took Phil 2 years to do it, was to bring some kind of systematic offense where other players had the ball, where the ball was shared, which would enhance Michael's threat and conserve some of his energy, which was very important, and yet when the Bulls got to the fourth quarter, allow him to be the individual one-on-one threat which so distinguished him.
David Halberstam recorded in 1999. We'll continue our remembrance with a 1993 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering the journalist David Halberstam. He died in a car crash yesterday. Halberstam shared a Pulitzer Prize in 1964 for reporting on Vietnam. He was one of the first reporters to challenge the optimistic picture of the war presented by American officials. Halberstam started his career in the 1950s. In 1993, he re-examined that decade in a book titled The 50s. He found that decade was much more interesting than it appeared on the surface. The decade remembered for conformity actually sowed the seeds for the social and political upheaval of the 60s and 70s. Halberstam covered the civil rights movement for Southern newspapers during the second half of the 50s. In 1993, I asked him why he wanted to write a book about the 50s.
Well, I wanted to write about it for a number of reasons. I had done The Reckoning, which is a book about America at a moment of jeopardy, you know, the Japanese beginning to challenge us industrially and economically. So I wanted to go back to a moment when we had been supreme, a time of real American economic hegemony, which was in the 1950s when everything, when God was in his heaven and the economic order was blessed and everybody's income went up 10% a year and inflation was low and everybody was spending more all the time. Part of that, I think, is also that I'm in some ways a child of the 50s. I graduated from high school in 1951 and from college in 1955. And many of these experiences, particularly the early civil rights days, because I was a reporter in Mississippi and Tennessee, were part of my life. And so, you know, I don't think journalistic autobiography is really very good. I mean, journalists spend 30, 35 years being reporters, and then someone with a book contract comes to them and says, we'd like you to write a book about your life. And the truth is, they don't really remember anything that happened. I mean, they sort of remember filing their dispatches from the PTT in Saigon or Leopoldville or Zaire, you know, or they say, you know, when I got to Paris to represent the New York Times, I felt that I got on quite well with General de Gaulle. While we were not exactly intimate, he would often say after press conference, Monsieur Halberstam, your question was beautifully phrased today. Your French is getting better. Well, you know, so this in a way is my way of doing my autobiography, but except in an exterior way. This is the world that I was part of and in some way helped form me.
Did you go back and you refer in the beginning of the book to pictures from the 50s that you were looking at and how formal they seemed, all the men in their suits, everything seemed to be in place, all the teenagers looking rather square.
And prim.
And prim, yeah.
The women are pert and the young women are pert and the young men are sort of four square and reliable. They have a would-be Tab Hunter look to them.
Yeah, if they were lucky, they'd be Tab Hunter.
Well, I may be not so lucky if they were Tab
Hunter,
too.
So did you go back and look at pictures of yourself also?
Well, I've led such a vagabond life that there are very few pictures of me in the 50s. You know, I've lived in great disorder. Those years were years first in Mississippi and Tennessee, and then immediately I was overseas. So an awful lot of stuff that I should have in my possession, I don't. But there is a very famous photograph taken, not famous to the world, but famous to me and my colleagues, taken in 1954 on the Harvard Crimson. Three or four of us are sitting there with the editors, and we're sitting with Adlai Ewing Stevenson of Illinois, who is then the most beloved of liberal Democrats. And we're sitting there, and there I am. My hair is very short and very black, a great deal blacker than it is now. My face is sort of square and kind of a can-do American face. And I'm wearing the requisite tweed jacket and gray flannel slacks. And dear God, my wife really loves this photo because it shows how much she's improved me in recent years. White socks. There it is, the man with the white socks. So there are not a lot of photos existing, but there are a lot of photos in my mind of me in the 50s, of the simpler time and of my own ambition to be a reporter in the civil rights movement and of America in change.
You went to Harvard in the 1950s.
1959. I entered in 1951.
What did you see for yourself when you looked ahead? Did you see yourself as being, you know, a leader of tomorrow?
No. I came from a sort of middle-class background. We never had any money, but because my father had served in the war in World War... The Depression in World War II had cut us out of money, and we never had money, but we had... we were middle class. There was never any doubt that my brother and I were going to go to college, and we were supposed to therefore trying, in the tradition of the children of Jewish immigrants, to go to the best, and by some mistake we both got into Harvard from public high schools, and I never saw myself as a leader of men. What I wanted to do very badly, very early on, was to be a journalist. I thought that was what I wanted, and I wanted to see if I could do it and do it well. And if I could do that, I wanted to be in on the action. I wanted to be a part of events. My heroes were men like Hodding Carter, who was the great Mississippi journalist who fought the Klan, and John Gunther, the wonderful globe-trotting journalist, and Theodore White, who was already writing wonderful books, and Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times, who was, when I was a sophomore in college, writing from Moscow for the New York Times. And I mean, it's interesting because there was a recent review of one of my books in the Boston Globe, and it referred to me as this generation's Theodore White and John Gunther. And I thought, what a wonderful thing. I have become in the same lineal collection as my heroes. I'm like the kid who wanted to play center field for the New York Yankees when he was a little boy and ended up growing up and doing it.
Now, the 50s was the decade that there was the first teenage generation that knew what it meant to be a teenager. In other words, teenagers had their own lifestyle. Teenagers became their own market. Yeah,
the coming of the youth culture. Yeah,
exactly. Now, were you a part of that? Or?
Oh, God, no. No, I'm really I'm an interesting person in the sense that my mores are set in the 50s. I'm a 50s person. And by that, I mean growing up. The dates that are important in my life, 11 years old at the end of World War II. So, I mean, I knew the Depression. I knew World War II. I had all the cautiousness of that part of the 50s. And then because of my own odd professional choices, being part of the early civil rights movement, I mean, covering the early civil rights movement, and then also covering Vietnam very early on and being one of the earliest pessimists, I have the odd contradiction of having a lot of the things that flowered in the 60s in me, but being a square from the 50s. I'm a square who got caught up in the most primal issues of the 60s. So I have a foot in both camps. I mean, my values in many ways are very old-fashioned and conservative, but my political allegiances are profoundly affected by the shattering duality of those events, civil rights change in Vietnam.
Well, you write about the coming of rock and roll in the book. Did that have any impact on you?
Well, see, sort of less. I think when I was about 21 when I was in West Point, Mississippi, which is 50 miles north of Tupelo, and I was at Partlow's drive-in one night, and someone said about this guy singing Hound Dog or Heartbreak Hotel. Is he one of them there at Tupelo Presley's? I mean, I used to watch Elvis's, Chet Atkins, the great guitar player, used to run the RCA studios in Nashville, and Chet was a pal. I'd go hear him play in Printer's Alley, and he would let me sneak in, and Elvis, who was exactly my age, it would come in, and I'd be hidden away watching these great secret sessions. But I was never as profoundly affected by rock. I think maybe, I was 21 when it happened, which means my music of choice and which fashioned me is when I was a boy in my parents' home. So it's really much more likely to be Sinatra and music of that generation. But Elvis is a critical figure. He's the first great coming of the youth culture.
Are you telling us that you actually were at recording sessions with Elvis Presley in the 50s?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was the one reporter allowed to be, for example, Colonel Parker, when Elvis came back from the Army, Colonel Parker allowed me to be the one reporter to travel with him on his train ride back from Fort Dix to Memphis. And he's my age. He was a very sweet young man in those days. Anyway, the great moment, this is two really important political moments in the 50s. One is Brown versus Board of Education.
Wait, I have to stop you a second.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We'll get back to this.
Okay.
So what did you talk to Elvis about on the train?
Well, I said, how does it feel? I mean, there are these girls squealing at every stop. He says, I don't know. I said, Why do you think it happens? He said, Mister, I don't know why it happens, but it's happening. I'll do the best I can with it. He was this very shy, quite modest country boy, not unlike a lot of others. There was this fluke thing that had happened. He didn't quite understand, but he was going to do the best he could with it. He called everybody, sir. He called me, sir. I was his own age. I looked at him and I said, hey, is that a suntan? He said, hell no, that's a wind tan from being a tanker in Germany.
How'd you like being called, sir?
Well, it was about the first time. Other than a few years, 20 years later, when you called me, sir, it really hasn't happened very
often. I think that's maybe a Southern thing.
But it was, I found him very sweet, and I thought incredibly unpretentious. I mean, there was no arrogance. Now, may have there been secret arrogance behind the calling of everybody, sir or man, but he seemed to me about the least rebellious young man I'd ever met. Anyway, this is, I think, a two critical political moments. One is Brown versus Board of Education, which I think forever changes America racially, culturally, in every moral. I mean, this country has changed forever by that decision. The second one is, I think, the moment when Elvis goes and sings on Ed Sullivan's show. Ed Sullivan is, in any real reason, in those days, the true American minister of culture. He decides what's going to go on his show, what's mainstream American and what is not. He's not just only a variety entrepreneur. He's a censor in any real sense. And he says very publicly, I am not going to have this young man, Elvis Presley, on my show because what he does is dirty. And so Elvis goes on Steve Allen's rival show on Sunday night. Steve Allen has never beaten Ed Sullivan before in the ratings. Elvis goes on, and for the first time in history, Steve Allen wins. And with that, Ed Sullivan quickly folds his tent, surrenders, sends Colonel Parker a telegram booking Elvis for three shows at $50,000. Elvis comes on, and that is the end of the old order. The old order, which would like to keep Elvis off, can't because of the commercial power of the new youth demographics. And Ed Sullivan quickly goes on and says, we've never had, I want to say this about Elvis, this young man is the finest young man. We've never had a better experience with a young man. And of course, they shoot him, by the way, from the waist up. But that is as dramatic a moment in American culture. That's a very important political benchmark.
You were one of the first reporters to challenge the government when you were reporting on Vietnam. Yeah. In the decade before, the 50s, the decade that you write about, you were covering the civil rights movement. And you were seeing probably a lot of authorities who were masking the truth. Were the roots of your skepticism about the official truth, were those roots for you in the 50s?
Yes, I think covering the civil rights movement was a great place to go and start taking skeptical pills. I mean, you'd go into a town and the mayor would say, hey, you know, our colored folks, they're all happy here. They like it. My maid just told my wife today, you know, that those people there with Martin King, that they're all troublemakers, troublemakers from the North, the communists. They would say, and they'd say the NAACP, except they'd always deliberately mispronounce it and say the NACCP. They'd always deliberately, you know, and they'd say that Martin Luther, and then, you know, they'd make some pejorative reference to King. I mean, very early on in the South, since the entire matrix of established authority, mayor, governor, by and large senator, judges, were all so totally lined up against the forces of integration and obeying the law of the land, that very early on, and they obviously were convinced that whatever movement there was to the indigenous civil rights movement in their own states and communities, therefore was not legitimate, and it was only orchestrated by what they thought was outsiders. And there I was with other reporters going around and talking to the local black people and knowing that they very much indeed wanted to have integration. They wanted the better things of American life. They wanted their children to go to better schools. They wanted to make more money. They wanted to enter this society as a full-fledged member, and that these were very strong, powerful, proud people. So that was there was a healthy, you know, amount of skepticism that you picked up then.
David Halberstam recorded in 1993. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist died in a car crash yesterday. We're shocked and sorry that we'll never have the chance to talk with him again, but we will be able to read him in a book about the Korean War scheduled for publication in September. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new CD by blues singer Coco Taylor. This is Fresh Air. Coco Taylor long ago earned her title Queen of the Blues. In the mid-60s, she came to Chicago from a sharecropper farm in Tennessee. There she was discovered by the celebrated songwriter and performer Willie Dixon, who provided her with her crossover hit Wang Dang Doodle. After her label Chess went out of business, she signed with Alligator Records in 1975. She has a new album called Old School, and critic Milo Miles says it embodies Alligator's straightforward, hard-rocking blues style.
Come on now! Play the blues!
Coco Taylor is the last of the blues hot mamas. She's now 71 years old, and when she was hospitalized for months back in 2003 and 2004, it seemed her nearly 40-year career might be over. But the title of her new album says it all, Old School, and you don't count out somebody from the old school. Taylor has never made a weak, careless album, but what's most impressive is that this one is one of her most potent and determined. Old School is straight Chicago blues, with a couple spots for a sax solo, but mostly electric guitars, as close to the thrash and punch of the 1950s as anybody can get today. Taylor hasn't spent much time singing about being wronged or missing someone who's gone, though she can nail those moods. Her favorite approach is to challenge men to keep up with her, as a hellraiser, as a lover, as a vibrant human being. If the guy doesn't, why, she might trade him in for a mule. Special mention has to go to guitarist Steady Roland Bob Margolin and Chris Johnson, who is also Taylor's longtime producer. Their guitar buzz and clatter is both timeless and in the moment. Old School sounds like the 50s, but it doesn't feel like a throwback. Nor is there any nervous attempt to sound contemporary. Taylor's attempts at updating herself have been hit and miss. One track, Memphis Minnie's Black Rat, was originally recorded a lifetime ago in a world that no longer exists. But as long as Coco Taylor knows what the song's about in her bones, so do you.
Yeah, you sleep in my kitchen, eat up.
Blues skeptics claim not enough is done to change the form, and the audience nowadays accepts hack work. There's some truth in this. Old school's innovation, however, is to deliver the tone and temperament of the blues full-bodied and uncut. That's more of an achievement than it might seem. At the center is indomitable Coco Taylor and her rasping thunder of a voice. She will not be ignored or dismissed.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Coco Taylor's new album, Old School. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Last King of Scotland, starring Forrest Whitaker, on DVD today. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with presidential historian Robert Dalek about his book Partners in Power, Nixon and Kissinger. Dalek describes the two as self-serving characters with grandiose dreams of recasting world affairs. Join us for the next Fresh Air.